This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
I don't think there's anything much more fun for an interviewer to interview interviewers about interviewing. If I can make it through that tongue twister, I think we'll get through this just fine. I have the greatest of pleasure to introduce Jane Hutchin, Philip Chubb and Ramona Cobbale to this session. Let me start with the premise. Interviewing is a privilege, isn't it? What do you think, Jane?
Absolutely. I mean, to get someone to take several hours out of their day, usually that's the minimum they'll take, sit down and then be... They don't think they're being grilled with me. I think most people think they're coming in for a nice friendly chat. But, you know, you don't say anything and people normally say something when you leave a space there. And soon it's like their lives have spilled out. So how lucky am I? But everybody ends up leaving feeling really good. It's a bit like therapy for us all.
Philip, do you think it's a privilege?
No, I think it's a right. I think that it's part of the process of accountability that we undertake. As journalists, I think we have a right to ask questions of people who set themselves up as public figures, and we have a right to anticipate that they'll give us answers which are truthful.
Ramona?
I think when you're interviewing public figures, it's a right. It's a privilege when you're interviewing people who aren't necessarily public figures, who are people whose lives have come into the public attention. They may not be held accountable for what they do necessarily. They just might be opening their hearts and minds and lives to you, and that is a privilege, I think.
Well, we're today talking about the craft of interviewing, so we're going to talk about some of the elements that go into getting good long-form interviews. Preparation. I sat down before this interview and I tried to assemble some ideas in a cogent form, and of course I got some way into it and then it all just became chaos and I said, let's just wing it and see how it goes.
You didn't.
There are some interviews where I find that where I'm dealing with lots of topics, that's the best way to do it. Just in the end, leave it to the lap of the gods. How do you prepare? How do you...
I would never do that in a million years. I'm too neurotic for that. I have to prepare. I have to have read everything that the person's already told other people. I have to read everything I can that they've written themselves. I have to watch other interviews. Because part of the thing is to try and get under a kind of a wall of a barrage of, you know, I've been asked this a million times and I'm going to give the crafted, beautiful answer that I have trotted out every time, and I'm going to deliver it in such a way that this person won't notice. But I do. And so I try and make sure that I can ask questions that haven't been asked before. And as someone who's been interviewed as a writer, I know that as soon as you see with somebody who's read your work and who's got a really interesting angle and who makes you go, I haven't thought about that. Well, what is my answer? And then you start to sort of think on your feet and you let them into a kind of a thought process, and you give them something more than they expect.
I think sometimes the preparation can get to over-preparation to the point where you're less able to think on your feet as a result. What do you think, Jane? Is that...
Yeah, you're right about that, because sometimes you're... particularly for a program like One Plus One, where you have to tell a story. It has to have a beginning, middle and end, just like an Australian story or, you know, a 7:30 report story. So you have to take them on a journey. You can't stick on one subject and hammer them on one thing for 10 minutes. And so you obviously have to get the main arc of their lives, but then getting those little interesting nuggets of information. I interviewed an 80-year-old lady the other day about her early life where she was in a prisoner of war camp, and I hadn't thought to ask her, you know, whether she had, how she'd sort of come to terms to this as an adult. And then she started telling me about how she'd blocked it away for 70 years, and it had only started to come out when she'd read a completely different book about war. And then she cried for 7 days nonstop. And I was so lucky that this managed to get into the interview at the end, because I was focusing on, you know, well, this happened, I know this, and I wanted her to talk about this, that it was only when she happened to say, it was locked away inside me and I didn't think it was ever going to come out until I read this book. And I was kicking myself. But, you know, as an interviewer, you always do kick yourself, because there's always that question that you either miss, or because you're focusing on the research, you tend to just, I need that.
Well, we're talking here about at least two forms of long-form interview. We're talking about the performance interview, where it is in and of itself the interview that is the end product. And we're also talking about the kinds of interviews that we all do, which become component parts for long-form narrative, and they're very different interviews. Now, Philip, you've done both, but you've done of late a lot of the latter, a lot of these component interviews that make up a long-form narrative.
Mostly the latter. Far more so than. Thank you.
Sorry, old habits die hard.
than live interviewing. So I suppose my way of answering the question would be to say there's preparation and preparation, and there's preparation and then more preparation. So, yes, if you read and you look at what they've done and you consider it and you evaluate it, and you talk to other people about it, and you formulate questions, and you imagine what the outcome might be. But for the sort of work that I've done in TV documentaries and books, I also have a process of seeing people more than once, so that for main interview figures, I would often prepare for an interview by having coffee with them at least once beforehand to get through the mechanical aspects of the preparation, if you like, but also to begin to establish a rapport with them, which is really so vital to obtaining the information that you need for a narrative. And often I would do that more than once, particularly if they're key people. In my particular case, the sort of work that I do, and it goes to the question of whether I would see interviewing as a right or a privilege, because, you know, I would often talk to political leaders, in fact, far more often than not. But even with them, people who have had a lot written about them and where their careers and activities and policies and so on have been subject to a lot of scrutiny and discussion, I would never go into an interview cold, and I would never interview them only once.
Well, I think something you've alluded to there, which I find really interesting, is this idea of the pre-interview. Now, I found that strange moving from radio to television, that you wouldn't invest in sending out a crew to interview people unless you had a good idea that they were good talent. So you'd pre-interview them. And then the danger is that in pre-interviewing, you'd set up an awareness of what the answers will be. You get out there and they've rehearsed the answers and you kill all the spontaneity. So how do you do that in these interviews or discussions that you have with them before, that you don't telegraph the questions and destroy the process?
Well, I think it becomes, and you don't just do that for TV. I suppose what I'm saying is that I do that for books as well. It becomes a process of moving from discussion to interview, and ensuring that they are honest. So anything that is raised or discussed or argued about in an initial conversation that you have with them, you have to hold them to that, make sure that, you know, there's no question that that's said on the record, and that can become a tussle, but it's part of the process, and I suppose with experience you get to understand how to do that.
Jane, is this an issue, the pre-interview, and how it affects things?
I don't like pre-interviewing. I only pre-interview when I cannot get enough research to fill in the basic building blocks, the basic structure of the interview. I have a very small team. I basically work with another producer, and we sit down together before the interview, and we know that what we're going to get is we have no guarantees, and we also think sometimes we can pick what's going to be a good interview, and we are so wrong. So it's almost about the moment, and you sit down and you have. So I've researched the life out of this person, and I sit down in front of them, and all of a sudden you have to at least read a book or see their play or film, because you have to hear their voice in your head. And you'll sit down in front of them, and you either know that the voice you've heard in the book, usually if they've written it entirely on their own, is the one that's coming at you. Sometimes it's completely the opposite, and that floors you. But it's all in that 5-minute build-up and the opening question. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we stumble at the beginning, and I look at my producer and she looks at me, and she always just puts her head down when she doesn't want to show her reaction. And so I know I've got a big climb ahead, or else we sort of sit back and we know here comes the magic. It's quite a sort of, is alchemy the right word? I'm not sure, but it's a very sort of in the moment kind of thing, very different from, you know, those political interviews that you're sort of, you need to get the absolute truth out of them, and they need to trust you. Yeah, this is about the moment, and do I like her questions?
It's the point at which preparation transfers to performance or to the interview process. And
well, I mean, it also depends on the interviewee, amazingly enough. It's all very well if you look at the territory and plot out your path, and, you know, you go in with 30 questions for an hour, and then you may or may not use them all, but you know that that's a safety net, and then they might say something interesting and that you haven't expected, and you can go off there, but you know you can come back to other things and all of that. But if the person isn't prepared to enter into the spirit of things, then you don't really have the other half. And I think this idea of trust is really important, because it depends on how, you know, if you're going back to them, they get to know what you're like. They know, if they're smart, they can know enough about, as much about you as you know about them. But if you create a situation where they feel that they are being heard, then, people relax and they say things.
That's the key, is it? Showing them the basic respect. I think being listened to and heard.
Showing you're serious, setting a tone of respect. I'm here because you've written this or done this or said this, and I'm here to have a conversation with you. I'm not here to trap you. I'm not here to make you look bad. That's why I would do an interview.
Did you like to pre-interview?
No, not at all.
I
just want it to be in the moment. It was live mostly, and so you want it to be interesting and quirky and deep and whatever else. There's sort of alchemy, as you say, was going to provide.
Yeah, I think that the danger in going straight into an interview with somebody in a situation where it's not live, so where you're interviewing somebody to obtain information that you intend to weave together into a narrative, is that they will treat it as though it's live. And because frequently that is the experience that people have. And so you'll wind up in, if you're not careful, you can wind up in a situation where they're thinking, how do I answer this question in 30 seconds and provide a grab? That's to give an extreme example. Or they're thinking to themselves, if I answer this in a particular way, what will the next question be? And so you're potentially setting up, in certain circumstances and with certain people, confrontational approach when that's the last thing that you actually want. What you want is something which is relaxed and expansive, which wouldn't just simply would not work if it were live. It would drag on forever, which these interviews sometimes do.
It's not to say you can't do relaxed and expansive on live television or live radio.
Well, it depends how relaxed and how expansive.
But do you record your pre-interviews?
No, I don't. No, the pre-interviews, well, there sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. I think the process with television documentaries is that you do record the pre-interviews and write the script from the interviews, the audio interviews. In my experience, that process has worked pretty well. With written narratives, books, I don't record them, no. I take some notes, but I don't record them.
Jane, your style of interviewing on 1+1 is as close, I think, as you get on TV to relaxed and expansive. You often create a mood where there is the capacity to slow things down a bit and to talk with reflection, and I think that must be quite deliberate.
We call it slow TV. it is deliberate, and when people walk into our space, which sometimes is one of our studios at the ABC, sometimes we make our space in their space at home. It is kind of like a cocoon that you're walking into, and, you know, they'll comment about the lights. And you sit down and you do have to... They've obviously got information and story that they want to tell you, but often just the... I think a lot of people have talked about this, not jumping to fill, and this is one of the things about live TV, and in a way why I'm glad I'm not doing news interviewing, because you can't have dead space. You can't wait for Julie Bishop to pause and say something, you know, she'll fill it with more stuff, and that's live TV. But on 1+1, the spaces almost make people reach over and open their bag and give you more that you don't expect. So it's really important to encourage if people look as if they want to say more about something, and sometimes just to not say anything. It can get quite poignant at times. Just two people looking each other in the eye, and sometimes it's almost like... I've started to cry a lot recently in interviews, usually after the other person, hopefully. And it's very interesting watching their eyes and they're watching my eyes, and the number of times that eyes fill up with tears, even if the tears don't come out. And that's about space and,
you know. There was a beautiful example of that in the one you did just the other day with the pastor from the Wayside Chapel. Absolutely beautiful story he told about his son. And you introduced this by asking him a question, and you obviously knew the answer, do you wear a watch?
Yeah.
And then you just watched, you used the word alchemy, what happened next? It was beautiful how this flowed to a story about the death of his son 7 years earlier, how he wore a watch to remind him, which went to an even more beautiful anecdote about how he'd run into somebody recently in the chapel who'd stopped him as he was trying to walk out. So what happened next?
Yeah, so the man had stopped him, and he was Graham Long. I think this is still actually on iView.
It is. Have pastor, a look at it. It's a wonderful interview.
The pastor, Graham Long, was in a hurry, and this guy wouldn't get out of his way. And I think he told a joke about how $2 fixes practically every problem at this community street centre, the Wayside Chapel. And the man stopped him, gave him a kiss, didn't know this man, and the man said, that's from your son, and it just stopped him in his tracks. And those kind of things send chills down me too as I'm listening. You can't help but be affected by it.
And he said this was the moment that he effectively stopped grieving and started living in the present.
That's right. And that was the thing about the watches as well. It was a constant reminder. Actually, what he said later, as we were walking out, the clock, his watch had actually, his son's watch had actually stopped at 1 minute to midnight, and it 1 minute to 12, and it reminds him that we've all got 1 minute left, and it reminds him about living in the present. And I am just so awful at that. I need reminding about living in the present all the time. I seem to live my life either far forward or you know, always in the past. And I love it when I meet people who just seem to be so much of the moment. And in a sense, the weekly interviews are that for me. You know, they're keeping me there in the moment.
Why did you ask him about the watch?
Oh, because it broke my heart when I read the story about how he'd gone to so much to adopt children because he couldn't father children of his own. And this beautiful boy that he'd adopted suddenly dropped dead when he was 29, you know, having two young children. And he'd been through, Graham Long had been through a lot of things, but I just thought, that is just so unfair.
So you read about the watch and then you raised it in the interview because you'd read about it?
Yeah, I read about it in his book. And
did you feel trepidatious about raising the watch?
No, I didn't, because he was a strange fellow. He was so humble that he didn't really want to talk about a lot of things, but at the same time there was a generosity there. And you always know you get permission. You both know this, don't you? People give you permission to say things. They want to say them, and it's you see something about them that says, please, ask me about him. I need to talk about him. And that's exactly what I felt at that time.
Well, I get the sense that when I see your interviews that you know some of these answers already. And in fact, I think for TV, there's a wealth of anecdotes about a lot of the people we interview because they're already famous, they've been profiled, and we tap into some of those. But what we all hope for is that they'll take us somewhere new, and that's what we're after, isn't it, the newness.
Mm.
And how do you go looking for that, Ramona?
by being this old. I've been around the block a bit, and I've met a lot of people, and I've had a few experiences. And so I can kind of apply wisdom to things that I may not have been able to do before.
And getting them to open up, of course, is the other thing. And I think we should talk about Gillian Triggs now, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
that's exactly what you did with Gillian Triggs not long ago in an interview for the Saturday paper. This was a print-based interview which took on a life of its own, where Gillian, as the Human Rights Commissioner, open up in an extraordinary way.
Well, you know, I mean, I just had been trying to get an interview for about a year and going backwards and forwards with her office, and she had actually said she would talk to me a year before, and then it got put off by a Senate estimates hearing, and one thing led to another. So just in, you know, I sent her office a note and sent her a note, CC'd her, saying, well, it's been a year since I last spoke or emailed you. How about it now? And then it was agreed that I come up to Sydney, and which I did. And I had an hour and a half in her office. I'm neurotic, so I had belt braces and belt for recording, so I took my laptop, I recorded on that, I recorded on the iPad.
Which would later prove to be very useful.
Yeah, iPad and my phone, just in case. And so it was all set out.
Tell us the...
There was no question
about
what
she said. What did she say?
Being recorded. She was terrific. She said that, you know, I asked her questions about things that she'd... talked about. She'd just come back from an UN conference about, you know, Australia not signing up to treaties. And so, you know, we set a framework of, you know, her seriousness about our obligations in refugee policy and human rights. And so we talked about a lot about that.
And about her disappointment about Australian politicians' lack of knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought it was a terrific interview. So we spoke for an hour and a half. I really like, you know, the way it ended. I mean, in fact, she says towards the end, You know, she talked about how what she was thinking at the, as the 9 hours unfolded from the Senate estimates experience with the rude senators, and the, you know, the extent of the hostility and the personal natures of the attacks. And I think I say my last question to her: I see that you've not let the 2015 experience cower you. You've made many comments on matters that have you have proper concerns in, from marriage equality and safe schools programs to calling for monitoring of conditions for asylum seekers and refugees in offshore detention, blah, blah, blah. I said, it looks like if the government thought they could bully you into submission, they made rather the wrong call. And she says, I've just turned 70 and I've been doing this for a long time. And I'm so confident about the law and about the evidence for the law not being respected that I feel very sure-footed in going forward on these other issues. My resilience and determination and experience for a long time in the law give me the determination to get through the remaining 15 months to continue to speak out. When you see that you're being bullied by people who you know are not coming from a good place, you know you don't have to give in to them. They are cowards, and the moment you stand up to them, they crumble. And they did crumble. And several now have been seen off long before me. They're not used to a woman aged 70 standing up to them. They can't quite believe it. If I were 40 looking for a career opportunity, I probably wouldn't do what I've done because it would have queered the pitch for me professionally. But why do I care now? I can do what I'm trained to do and they almost can't touch me. And I'll continue to do that work when I've finished with this position.
We'll come to what happened next in a minute, but my quote from that is, she said, our parliamentarians are usually seriously ill-informed and uneducated. All they know is the world of Canberra and politics, and they've lost any sense of rule of law. And curiously enough, for Canberra, they don't even understand what democracy is.
That's right.
So did she know at that point she was spoiling for a fight or not? I mean, she was appearing before the Senate Estimates Committee again.
Well, of course she did. I mean, she's president of the Human Rights Commission.
But unfortunately, when she was before that committee, she was asked about this and she denied having made some of these statements or said that she'd been misquoted.
Yes, that was a bit of a surprise. And so I only knew about it when I got some phone calls and from journalists wanting to ask me about it. Yeah. And from the editor of the Saturday paper too, who... So then I just watched, that was the next day actually, so I watched Senate Estimates, so I could watch it and sort of looked at the whole thing. And, it was a big surprise to see the evidence.
So what are the lessons we take from this? Obviously record your interviews several times.
Yes, record your interviews. There's nothing wrong with that. I recorded them not for broadcast, and I actually have been asked since this whole thing broke for a copy of the tape for people to broadcast. But I've said no because Gillian Triggs retracted her statement as soon as Eric Jensen had written to her office to say that he'd heard the tape and she hadn't been misquoted and that she should retract, and she did. So there was no reason for me to let the tape be broadcast because she'd already said she was wrong. Also, I'd made the tape in order that I quote her properly and I didn't get anything out of context. So I felt that it had served its purpose and that was the reason for me making it. It wasn't for performance and it wasn't for any other reason. But the editor, you know, we called me, I played him the relevant bits over the phone, because nobody had had the tape up until then. He now has a copy of the whole 1.5 hours. And, that's important. Of course, when you get a call like that, when you see something like that in the Senate, you think, God, you know.
You start to doubt yourself.
Of course you do. You go, I know that I'm obsessive compulsive about this, but maybe I got it wrong. You do. So you have to go and re-listen, and you sort of... hoping against hope, you don't, you know, you hear what you've written, you hear it, and then when you hear it, you go, thank God.
Yeah, I think we've all been there. Philip, you've spent a lot of time interviewing people in Canberra. It's a viper's nest. What sort of interviewing and what sort of preparation and security, I suppose, do you have to have around interviews to ensure that what you're doing is going to hold up and be safe?
Safe from what?
Safe from the kind of bickering later, the contestation of what was said, the public scrutiny around the interviewing process.
Oh, I think there's always public scrutiny and contest. I think the only way you can prepare for that is develop a thick skin. It will happen. Can I just make a comment about Gillian Triggs and the interview that Ramona did with her? And I'll come back to your question if you want me to. When I first read that, I thought that was the product of a much longer interview, an interview of the type that I was describing earlier, where everybody relaxes into the process and where people become willing or able or even unconsciously capable of saying things which are beyond what they would normally say in an interview which has a relatively brief time limit. And I had believed that right up until this minute, that it would have been an afternoon spent with a audio recorder running to get somebody to speak as freely as that. Gillian Triggs's response to this, and perhaps it's a useful comment or not, I'm not sure, response to her quotes being made public and then her being the subject of attack yet again, then caused me to think, well, perhaps even in a shorter period of time, in other words, in an hour and a half, you created such a rapport with her that she was that she dropped her guard. Because a person as experienced as her would not have said those things if she didn't want to have a fight about them. She would have understood in normal circumstances, in a normal quick interchange in the space of an hour and a half, that all hell would break loose. And I think that perhaps what we're dealing with here is a great credit to you as an interviewer, that in a relatively short period of time you caused her to open up in ways that it would take somebody like me many more hours to achieve.
Well, perhaps, but you know, she was, you know, you're only responsible for the questions and the interviewee is responsible for the answers. And I always think that the person must be ready to say what they say. I mean, you're not torturing somebody. You're not, you know, you're not getting them drunk. It was like, I think I was there from 10:30 a.m. to midday, so there was no alcohol involved. I'm just surprised that she didn't say what she said in the last paragraph when questioned by the Senate.
Mm.
Yes, these are my answers, and I still think this, and I don't really have anything more to say about it. And would you like to ask me a question about the way the Human Rights Commission spends its money, which is, after all, what we're here to discuss in Senate estimates?
Mm. I'm not quite sure that I agree with you, though, that there isn't something about the interviewing process that beguiles people, you know, that old expression about interviewing, that it's an act of seduction.
But Gillian Triggs gets interviewed a lot, I imagine.
But there is something in some people's manner in interviewing that allows people to be drawn in and say things that they walk out of there and go, well, I didn't think I'd say that, and I ended up saying it. And
well,
I think
she
sometimes
didn't even know she'd said it.
Yeah. So I don't know whether you're being modest, Ramona, but I think there is some chemistry or something going on, and I think I see that, Jane, in some of the interviews you do, that people find themselves opening up more than they'd thought they would.
I think Ramona is being modest, definitely. I mean, Gillian Triggs in that situation was obviously very relaxed.
She was happy that I had done all the reading. Mm-hmm. She knew that I knew the statutes. She knew that I had read her reports on the Forgotten Children, and like the Senate, some of the Senate characters who were asking her questions about it, or, you know, refusing to read it. So, you know, if you take somebody's work seriously And you enter into the space of their work and their ideas and their life. And you say, here I am, I want to hear from you.
I think another way in which this beguiling happens is through trigger questions. And these are questions that open up a chain of thought or a process whereby the interviewee finds themselves going down a path where they begin to tell more of themselves than they otherwise might have. I saw that a little bit with Todd Sampson in an interview you did with him where you asked him about his mentor at school, Jane. And this is, it opened a series of answers for him that revealed a whole side of his life that I didn't know about. So is this what you do? Is what you find ways in to get them to open up?
You do. In a sense, it's a bit like, fishing sounds a bit mean because it's like you're trying to sort of hook a particular thing. You don't know when that's going to happen, but sometimes you will drop a question in. And I mean, what I found, it's been a few years since the Todd interview, but what I found incredible about that person was he is such a controlled individual and is so, you know, he's in his 40s and control is his thing, particularly where his body is concerned. And I was just gobsmacked to hear about his early life. Like, his mum used to work at Kentucky Fried Chicken and bring home, they used to eat bucket loads of Kentucky Fried Chicken, and his dad, I think, did something with Coke. So he had a really bad nutritional pattern as a child. And I think one of his brothers was morbidly obese. And all of those things about his childhood, the only way he could escape was to climb mountains and be physical. And I love that this creative leader who's now making TV shows, because he is very honed in a lot of different ways, I love that I know that about his background in a place called Sydney in Canada. So, you know, I think you're always being given these gifts of, you know, what motivates a human being and what a human being can be comfortable with and what drives them.
It's not really a trigger question. It's good old-fashioned empathy. Mm. It's what we read novels for,
yeah.
Because novels are the only way we really get to know what somebody else is thinking. We can't even get to know what our intimates are thinking, really, or our children or our lovers, you know, because... it's really putting oneself in the place and wondering how you might fare with the cards that have been dealt to the other person.
I think of it almost as curiosity too. It's what ignites my fascination about this person, and whether that's empathy or not, it may well be. But you know, it's this: what do I want to know more about? Fundamentally, is what drives a lot of this, and
yeah.
It's often about the human condition.
Absolutely.
I think empathy is fundamental, though. I think that that's a very important word in the context of a discussion like this about interviewing. And of course, that then raises the question which presumably you're heading in the direction of, which is betrayal. because the two do go together.
Mm.
And you do... I can only speak about the sort of interviews over my life that I have done, which have tended to be with public officials and senior politicians, including many prime ministers. And so it's best if I confine my comments to that, because I think there are other issues in other different types of interviews. But even there... In interviews with people who have been interviewed throughout their entire careers, in order for you to be able to establish the answers to the questions that you want in a truthful way, you have to approach them across the table in a way which creates empathy in both directions. You also, of course, need to be honest with them about your purpose in being there, which makes it harder sometimes to create that empathy. And your honesty is your shield then for what you do with the information material that you get afterwards, which frequently, well, not frequently, but which sometimes does them harm, and which creates the contests and the arguments about accuracy and requirements for verification and so on that flow.
And all those security things I was alluding to before.
Yeah.
Labour in power would have had its fair share of betrayal at the end of it, I imagine. This is such a brilliant series chronicling the Labour years of Hawke and Keating.
There are many people in this audience who weren't born then, of course.
Again, this is on YouTube and you should have a look at it if you haven't seen it. It is the seminal program in the sense of the post-mortem forensic reporting on governments at the end of their terms in office. And Labour in Power was made of, comprised of interviews with several of the leading officials and staffers of the Keating and Hawke years.
I mean, I had a relationship with Hawke and Keating and many other senior ministers who were interviewed as part of the process of developing that series. Remember here that we're talking about something that took a year and a half to do. and so this is long form, in a sense, and 5 hours of television. Neither Prime Minister ever spoke to me again. So I took that as evidence that at least I was even-handed. It's a bit different, though, and I keep referring to this difference. It is important. In the course of it, I had naturally a pretty good idea of what the outcome would be. I knew that what I was about to publish would not be popular with many of the people that I spoke to and would not be the outcome that either of those two prime ministers wanted. And the attitude that I took to that was that I saw them as big enough and ugly enough and seriously ugly enough to deal with whatever I served up to them. I saw myself as playing in an arena that was a big and a tough arena with people who knew what they were doing. And if they were inclined to be foolish, then it wasn't up to me to warn them in advance.
Jane, have you ever betrayed anyone?
Oh, yes.
So people have come out of these interviews that you've done with them feeling that they've been done over?
Oh, yes, most definitely. I interviewed...
It looks like you're in pain now as you speak.
Well, I have to say that part of the reason I moved on to interviewing was a sense that I'd betrayed far too many people in my 30 years of journalism, including my 10 years as a correspondent, by being the journalist always chasing the soundbite. And this weighed very, very heavily with me. And then I found myself presenting live news, and there was a series of incidents. My colleagues died in a helicopter crash, and I think a day after that, a family of eight in Brisbane died when their house burned down. And I just lost it. I just thought, I don't think I can do news anymore in this way. And part of my, I suppose, transition to interviewing has been this kind of like, you know, the only way I still think I can believe in a lot of news is if I talk about the other things behind the news, you know, about humanity. But even then, even when you think you're talking about people's motivation and inspiration and whatever, you still do betray people because, for example, one person I interviewed didn't think I would be talking about the fact that she'd laid off 2,000 people. And she felt that it was a personal interview. I said, but it's the elephant in the room. I mean, it might have been part of your job, but you must have had feelings as a human being making 2,000 people lose their jobs. And she threatened me with, she said, you'll be getting a letter from my lawyer. And we also realised that this was in the early iteration of 1+1, where we did several interviews in a half hour. We realised we had to be quite clear to, we had never said we wouldn't talk about those issues, but we had to be quite clear after that that this was an interview that was not going to, they have no restrictions. We always say we will go everywhere. You know, it's largely a personal interview, but we will go everywhere. And so we've had to be quite clear about that over the years as well, just setting up so that people know, yeah, it could involve the 2,000 people.
But you know, I just wanted to say, now, before you say that.
I know, before you say that, I want to say that we're about to take questions from the floor, so please get ready if you'd like to ask a question.
Ramona. I was going to say, this thing about without fear or favour, it's all very well, you know, when we sort of, you know, come through when we're younger and we think, oh, you know, without fear or favour, and it's a nice thing to do, but it actually is seriously a thing. Mm. And when you behave without fear or favour, you will not get a lot of bouquets.
No, you won't.
From anybody. You might get a few phone calls from fellow journalists who'll say, yeah, that was tough, and, you know, it's hard to be put in that position and you had no option or whatever, whatever. But you won't get, you know, I mean, a whole lot of people might adore your interview because it sort of fits into what their view of the world is. But, you know, if you have to sort of pull up and say, correct something that was wrong, you won't get a lot of love for doing that from the same sort of people. But you don't expect it. You just have to get used to it.
So Phil's point about having a thick skin is terribly important.
Absolutely.
But I think also Jane's point is that it's caustic over a long time. And I think all of us get to the point in journalism where you want to do something different other than just tell negative stories. I mean, I had reached the point where I wanted to celebrate success for a little while rather than just be critical of things.
But why should Why shouldn't you do that as a journalist as well?
Well, exactly.
It's very hard in daily news to do that.
But if you're working in a long-form area on a long-form project, then really both are involved,
yeah.
Both praise and criticism. Mm.
Yep.
And the people who are criticised won't notice the fact that they're praised elsewhere. They will only notice the criticism. Mm.
Let's take some questions.
Can I just say that I interviewed Norman Mailer once, and he said he never remembered any positive review, but he could quote negative reviews from like 50 years before. So, yeah, you're right. People remember the slights, don't they?
We'll accept negative or positive questions.
Thank you all for your insights. Jane, I watched your 1+1 with Treehouse author Andy Griffiths, and in it you said, in all your years of journalism, you've always found closing to be an area of great difficulty.
Oh, yeah.
You've just taken my closer off me. I was going to do that.
I work in community radio, namely longer form talks programs, and so I just wanted to ask perhaps all of you, when it comes to closing off the interview, how do you honour the interviewee and the information that you're garnering, particularly if you're having a really good conversation?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And I have a lot of difficulty with closing stories. And how I normally close an interview is sometimes we come full circle, but I always try to finish it on a real up note, so that if somebody's just told me about losing everything, I'll try to change the sort of momentum of the interview by asking them maybe what they learned from that time when they were at rock bottom. And sometimes it doesn't come, like we go even deeper and even deeper. And I had this situation recently with Michael Caton, the actor, that we just couldn't find an upswing to end the interview on. So eventually we chose to end it on, you know, I can't remember, I think it was something about what he was working on at that moment. But I think it's really important to leave that person I'm interviewing, as well as the audience, with a sense of hope. That's how I liked when I read books and when I listen to interviews. I want to end on a feeling like I can get up and, oh, you know, walk away from it. So I always try, even if we're at the depths, to rise up again and end it on a note that, you know, we can all walk out and be happy about it.
And this would be a perfect place to end it. We've got another 10 minutes to go. So, another question?
Thank you to the panel. Is there ever a time where you think, no, I'm not going to interview someone? And this is inspired by reading Philip's wonderful book, Power Failure, where Gillard and Swan and the others spoke freely and openly, and Kevin Rudd was very grudging and didn't add value. And I've done some interviewing in my time where I think, I'm going to go in, I'm going to ask these questions, going to get very polished, closed answers, so why waste my time and my reader's time?
I often felt like that when I was doing more political interviews before I started working in literary journalism, and I just thought, I cannot bear one more kind of cha-cha-cha with somebody. Well, I ask this, then you move left, then I move there, and you move there. And I thought, I just don't want to waste my life doing this.
Philip, do you want to answer that?
Well, I think that I understand the question extremely well. That's the first observation to make. And of course, we're all tempted to waste as little of our lives as possible talking to people who will only speak rubbish to us. I think that part of the ways that I try to overcome that is with the pre-interviews that I described before, so we can get the rubbish out of the way first. But I think that there are certain people, and Kevin Rudd is one of them, from whom you never escape the rubbish. So I think certainly the interview that I did with Kevin Rudd for that book was the most spectacular misfire I've ever had in an interview. And I came to understand with great detail and clarity exactly why so many people hated him. But would I have missed the experience? Well, not for quids, no.
So that's saying something. There were 70 interviews, I think, for that book, weren't there, Power Failure?
Yeah, roughly, yeah.
So I think the worst of 70 interviews. That's pretty good.
Well, no, the worst of hundreds. I'm talking
right,
about
okay.
A life. I'm talking about a lifetime here.
Next question.
Thanks to the three of you for a really interesting discussion. I'm wondering how often you encounter editorial difference of opinion in the aftermath and the packaging of your interviews, and how you go about resolving that.
Editorial difference of opinion between the interviewee and the interviewer, do you mean?
I think you mean between the interviewee, the interviewer and the company broadcasting it? Yeah.
Look, I don't think I've ever encountered that.
Mm. Have you, Ramona?
No, I don't think
so. It's a testament to the ABC, this, isn't it?
Oh, it's a testament to me and the ABC. Mm. Because you have to stand your ground.
Oh, true, okay.
You do have to stand your ground, yeah.
Yeah, I've not come across that. Always been well-backed and, you know, the people who work on the program are senior. I think we've all got fairly good judgment, so that really hasn't been an issue for me either.
Well, perhaps what we're asking about is the time you've stood your ground.
I've never been asked for a recording, you know, for evidence of what I've done before.
So when have you stood your ground then? When have you had to stand your ground on something?
Oh, God, it's a long, long time.
When you ask for more money.
I tell you what, I mean, once I was told, I did a show called Drive on Radio National for a few years, and it was 4 till 6 every day, and so there was a new manager who said everybody's interviews from now on should be 5 minutes. Everyone, 5 minutes, 5 minutes,
oh,
5 minutes. Because, you know, if you don't like that, we're going to have another one coming up. It's like a bus. You know, 5 minutes. And that day I had booked in Agnes Heller, I think, where she was sort of talking about her life in philosophy. She was from the New School of Social Research. So she was coming in live and something like that. She was either live or she was alive in another studio. And I thought, I'm not going to do this. 5 minutes went, 10 minutes went, 11 minutes, 12, 15. People started to come into the production booth. Management came in. There were lots of this sort of stuff, winding up signs. And that was it. And I think I did about 40 minutes. I did. Yeah, but you know what happens is then they say that they'd like to cancel your contract.
It's funny.
Which is what they did. But, you know, they said they needed a fresh voice for the next year, and they paid out my contract to the end of the year, that was exactly how much it cost to pay off my mortgage at the time. We're talking about the early 90s. And I thought, you know, now they've got someone who doesn't have a mortgage. Imagine how much you could get away with that. So, and funnily enough, then about a few weeks after my contract finished and I had two kids, I was a single mother, what am I going to do? Then I got approached by Robert Desai, who said that he was ill and he just wanted to take a year off and would I take over books and writing just for a year? And I went, sure. And I got a desk, three desks down from the one that I'd just been chucked out of. And I stayed at that job for, 13 years in books and writing and another six in
the bookshop. I don't think there was ever a five-minute interview on books and writing.
No, that's right.
We have roughly 5 minutes to go. So
basically it's a risk, but it's worth taking.
Question.
This is a really practical meat and veg question. Do you transcribe your own interviews, especially when you're working on books and doing 70 interviews?
I'm in the middle of doing this. I'll just be quick. I've just been on a 7-week international interviewing thing for my new book, and then I'm just back now transcribing, and it's the most annoying thing you can do, because but it's so valuable because you hear things you didn't hear, you remember things you didn't remember, you feel as if you were there, and you can imagine what they were wearing, and you remember something about the bookshelves behind them or something like that. It's really important that you do it yourself because it just gives you all kinds of avenues to go down that you didn't think you didn't have. What do you think?
Well, I do agree with that, although I don't transcribe my own interviews. Usually for these projects there are just far too many interviews and I couldn't possibly do it. But I'll give you an illustration of why it is important to do it if you can. I read around about this time last year a book that Tim Kolbach wrote on Dick Hamer. And I recall this. So it was a biography of Hamer. It was a very good book. And I was struck by a small thing. I'll try not to take too much time with this story. Dick Hamer resigned in 1981 after an interview was done by a journalist with the Warrnambool Standard of that journalist's local politician, who was also a member of that cabinet. And in that interview with the local journalist, the cabinet minister said that the Liberal Party was numb with fright, was the phrase, at going to the next election with Dick Hamer as leader. And the end result of that, being published on page one of The Age, a story that I happen to have written, was that Dick Hamer was forced to resign. And Kolbach, in a piece of terrific research... I was presented with a transcript of the interview between the Warrnambool Standard journalist and Ian Smith, the minister. And I wrote the Age story based on that transcript. Kolbach, in a terrific piece of research, actually went back to the Warrnambool Standard journalist 30-odd years later and listened to the interview and made the point in his book that he believed that Smith was speaking ironically when he used the phrase numb with fright. So I saw that phrase on a piece of paper as a transcript. It was the headline on page one of The Age.
I thought you were arguing for transcripts.
Libs numb with fright. No, at Libs numb with fright. Hamer is forced to resign. And 30 years later, I'm confronted with evidence from somebody who actually listened to the interview that the transcript, that it was that anyone reading the transcript would misinterpret the intent.
But why did he resign then? I mean, if it was a joke, why would you resign?
Because you can only tell it was a joke if you listened to the audio, and the transcript appeared so stark. That
but there must have been a kernel of truth in it.
Well, I mean, Hamer, yes, of course, he was being undermined, and that was the context in which the whole thing happened. But the actual phrase that caused all the trouble and that was in the headline was misinterpreted by me as a writer coming to it without being present at the interview.
I've got to say, this singularly fails as an upbeat ending. This is a total disaster.
Well, it's okay. Dick Hamer's dead now, so he doesn't care.
But we're over time, and part of a job of an interviewer is to wrap things up, so I'm going to wrap it up now. Jane Hutchin, Philip Chubb and Ramona Covell, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.